Welcome to KGNU's Morning Magazine for Thursday, June 8th of 2023. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Coming up on today's program, we'll have the latest installment in our award-winning Follow the Waste series, this time tracing the circular path of a glass beer bottle in Denver. Then, Radio Nibbles host John Lindorf joins us in the studio to look back on the 100 years of the sink. A BBC News update is at the bottom of the hour, then it's Black Talk with Michelle Simpson. This month, she has a preview of Juneteenth activities planned for Boulder County. At 9:30, Shauna Sprawls will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead, but first, a look at the headlines with KGNU's Benita Lee.
Boulder County officials are expected to announce their findings regarding the cause of the Marshall Fire in a 10 a.m. news conference today. The investigation has taken almost 17 months. Boulder County Sheriff Curtis Johnson and District Attorney Michael Dougherty are scheduled to speak at today's press conference. The Marshall Fire started on December 30th of 2021. Hurricane force winds and drought conditions fueled the fire, which destroyed over 1,000 homes and left two people dead. A lawsuit filed Wednesday by a Fort Collins-based company accused the aerospace giant Boeing Company of stealing their intellectual property. KGNU's Jacob Agatston reports.
Wilson Aerospace claims that Boeing sought Wilson's expertise in 2014 as Boeing struggled to safely attach engines to NASA's Space Launch System rocket. Wilson says Boeing canceled the collaboration after receiving their designs, but still used their trade secrets. According to the lawsuit, Boeing did not have full instructions on how to build and install Wilson's designs and created flawed, inferior, and unsafe machinery. Boeing allegedly blamed Wilson for dangerous design flaws that delayed the rocket's introduction while also taking in millions of dollars from NASA. The suit alleges that Boeing also stole proprietary information from Wilson in 2012 for the 787 Dreamliner aircraft. For KGNU, I'm Jacob Agatston.
Governor Jared Polis signed the Fostering Success Housing Voucher Program into law this week. KGNU's Pam Johnson reports.
SB 82 would create a voucher program to assist with stable housing for up to 100 youth who meet program criteria as they age out of foster care. Last year, around 150 Colorado youth transitioned from foster care to adulthood. Recent findings from the annual National Youth in Transition surveys revealed that approximately one-third of former foster youth in Colorado were experiencing homelessness at age 21. The voucher program will serve former foster youth who are between the ages of 18 and 26 and meet a set of eligibility criteria, including participation in case management services. The Colorado Departments of Human Services and of Local Affairs are working to develop a joint administration and implementation plan for the program, which aims to start administering vouchers to eligible youth in the fall of 2023. For KGNU, I'm Pam Johnson.
Denver's Department of Housing Stability wants to increase funding for an initiative that creates safe parking for people living in their cars. The nonprofit Colorado Safe Park Initiative is already organizing sites at Denver church parking lots. City officials would like to extend the contract with the charity by earmarking $600,000 for more parking sites over the next 3 to 5 years. According to Axios Denver, organizers say about 75% of the people who use the safe parking sites are experiencing homelessness for the first time, and their car is their last asset. And while many of them have jobs, they do not have enough money to pay for permanent housing. Congressman Joe Neguse introduced a bill Wednesday that would allow funding to continue for endangered fish recovery programs in the Upper Colorado and San Juan River basins beyond its original 2024 deadline. Under the legislation, water development projects could still move forward alongside the wildlife protection work. Boulder County Emergency Services aided a seriously injured biker at Walker Ranch on Tuesday afternoon. Mountain View Fire Protection District paramedics responded to a call the biker's partner made after she was thrown over the handlebars of her bike, resulting in head and neck pain. The paramedics stabilized her condition and transported the biker back to the trailhead using a full body splint. American Medical Response EMTs reevaluated the biker at the trailhead and drove her to a local hospital for continued medical care. The almost daily rain has left several waterways swollen and running fast. One result is a temporary ban on tubing. Officials at the Boulder County Sheriff's Office and the Town of Lyons say the North and St. Vrain Creeks and River will be closed to tubing and similar single-chamber flotation devices like rafts starting today at 8 a.m. In addition to rain, the South Platte River Basin snowpack is still above average, and the annual scheduled release of water from local reservoirs will raise currents above the levels that are safe for tubing. Violators will be fined $100. Partly sunny throughout the Front Range, a 50% chance of rain in the afternoon. In Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins, highs near 76 and lows around 55. For KGNU, I'm Benita Lee.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. What happens to that empty beer bottle after it's put in the recycling bin? Jamie Sudler of H2O Radio followed a bottle and learned what happens in Denver. This report is part of KGNU's ongoing Follow the Waste series, which is made possible by a grant from Boulder County's Zero Waste Funding Program.
And you're all set.
Great. Thank you.
Bottles of beer from local breweries pack the cold cases of liquor stores across Denver, but what happens to the glass bottles after customers enjoy their liquid contents? The city of Denver is encouraging residents to put them in purple recycling bins at no cost, and underscoring that suggestion by charging for solid waste destined for landfills. Beer bottles, along with yogurt containers, cardboard, and other recyclable items, go into one bin, called Single Stream, which then go to a sorting facility in southeast Denver.
Right behind you, what we're looking at is one of our trash trucks who's just completed its route. It'll come in, it'll get weighed, it'll head into one of these big barns here, depending on what's in the truck.
That's Vanessa Lacayo, a spokesperson for Denver's Department of Transportation and Infrastructure. We're at the Cherry Creek Recycling Facility. The site is massive, with trucks rolling in and out.
So the large barn toward the end is going to capture solid trash, and then in this kind of front load barn is what we'll do for recycling and compost.
So where do glass beer bottles go?
So it'll come to this facility first, and then it'll go to a materials recovery facility, or a MRF. We love an acronym.
Between the Cherry Creek Recycling Facility and the MRF, bottles are hauled to a facility in North Denver called GFL, which sorts all the recycling into different groups, plastic, paper, and glass.
And the glass will go to the glass recycler to be turned into a new bottle or jar.
One glass recycler taking material is called Glass to Glass in Broomfield, Colorado. They start the recycling process by removing all the contaminants, that is, non-glass materials like labels, adhesives, and maybe metals.
So we receive MRF material streams from several different MRFs in the greater Denver area.
That's Bob Hippert of OI, formerly Owens, Illinois, a corporation with facilities around the world, including Glass to Glass in Broomfield. He says they optically sort the glass into amber, green, and clear, and then produce what's known as cullet, small pieces of recycled glass that can be heated and made into new bottles. Those cullet pellets could either go to a facility that serves Molson Coors in Golden or to another OI facility in Windsor, Colorado, about 50 miles north of Denver, where I'm headed next in my Follow the Bottle journey. The Windsor plant is a massive and noisy place, humming with activity. Walking through it requires safety glasses, steel-toe shoe covers, and earplugs. The cullet, or broken glass, is brought by rail car at the east end of the facility, but even that's not enough to meet demand. The OI plant in Windsor doesn't get enough used glass in Colorado, so they use raw materials, sand, limestone, soda ash, and a little bit of alumina. The materials are then conveyed inside the plant, where two immense furnaces melt them into molten glass that flows into basins where it will eventually be molded into bottles. Bottles whirl through the plant on belts and ramps at a dizzying speed with incredible precision as computers track their progress from what looks like hot lava poured into molds to finished bottles that are cooled and then inspected. They are then bundled up to go to Budweiser, Left Hand, or New Belgium, among others. The plant runs daily around the clock, making about 3.5 million bottles a day. Hippert says that using recycled material from old beer bottles saves energy.
Adding recycled content reduces the amount of energy that you need to put into the furnaces to melt your glass. The typical rule of thumb is for every 10% cullet increase in your batch formula, you can save about 2.5% energy savings.
But the savings could be much higher.
You know, if it was up to me, we would have a whole lot more access to cullet at that facility. Our goal at OI is to try to run 50% recycled content in the bottles that we produce.
Given low recycling rates in Colorado, they import glass cullet from recycled bottles from other states as far away as Oregon, which has had a law for over 50 years that pays a fee to customers to return their empties. So why doesn't Colorado recycle well?
Unfortunately, more than half of the glass that is taken off the shelf and could be recycled is thrown into the landfill in Colorado.
That's Liz Chapman of Recycle Colorado, the largest nonprofit in the state dedicated to education about and lobbying for recycling. She says Coloradans only recycle about 16% in total of what could be recycled, which is about half the national average. Many bottles end up in landfills because some places in the state don't have adequate recycling options. Chapman is quick to add, the bulk of the glass that's not being recycled is not coming from residences, but from many bars and restaurants that don't have the time or finances to recycle.
But on the other hand, we have a glass remanufacturing facility right here in our state. So the potential to create jobs and supply that facility with the glass it needs to make glass out of recycled content is very high.
The recycling landscape is changing in the state after the legislature passed the Producer Responsibility Program for Statewide Recycling Act last year. The bill imposes charges on firms that make bottles, cans, paper packaging, and food utensils to fund recycling around Colorado. The program is getting established by first performing a needs assessment, and hopes are it will be fully implemented in about 3 years. And in last November's election, Denver voters approved a measure that requires restaurants, office buildings, and apartments to offer recycling. That could mean any beer bottle has a chance for an everlasting life. For KGNU's Follow the Waste series, I'm Jamie Sudler.
Have a banana. Is your mouth watering right now, hearing those notes? It should be, because you know it's time for Radio Nibbles. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Shannon.
Nice to have you back, or nice for me to be back to yes.
Welcome back, and welcome everybody around the gigantic KGNU breakfast buffet table, wherever you are in the world listening. And, you know, we recently celebrated 45 years on the air for KGNU, which seems like incredibly long and historical and everything. My guest owns a restaurant that was on the air, that was open and serving burgers 45 years, excuse me, before KGNU went on the air. The Sink. My guest is Mark Heinrichs, the owner of The Sink. Welcome.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
What's your history with the, for those who don't know, and I have a hard time imagining that anyone doesn't, The Sink is an institution up on the hill for generations. I figured out it's at least 25 generations of students who, and staff and professors who've eaten and celebrated and everything there. So it's known internationally. But how did you, How did you come into the sink world?
Yeah, so my brothers and I were young 20-somethings, and we met the Kavars, who were business brokers, and they were talking to them about businesses they might have for sale, and they brought up that they were thinking of selling the sink, and what do we think about that? So it started the conversation way back in 1992. And as young 20-somethings, I was only 26, Chris was 24, I think James was 28 then, we bought the sink. And it became a life after a while. You know, you hit a certain point of doing something for so long, you figure you might as well stick with it.
And the sink is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. And you decided to really capture the history of the place, and a documentary has been produced, which is going to be screened at the Boulder Theater on June 14th.
That's correct. Yeah, we have, over our 31, almost 31 years of ownership there, constantly, almost daily, heard stories from people of their time at the sink, and we thought this was really the opportunity and appropriate moment to try to do something more formal about coalescing all these stories in this gigantic history. And so we commissioned a documentary with Pixel Mill Studios, and they really dug into it. I got to give those guys a lot of credit. They thought they could do something in 8 or 10 minutes. And after they started pulling on this thread and ending up with a truckload of yarn, they boiled down, I think it was 500 hours of material into a 30-minute documentary.
And I hope all of that footage eventually will go to the Museum of Boulder and be part of the kind of the historical archive.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
And folks, I am in the documentary. A long time ago, this is before your time, in the late 1970s, I was cooking mostly and trying to write on the side. And I applied for a job at the sink, and I worked there for one night in the 1970s. I always say I worked at the sink for a year one night. It was a very busy night. I was on the grill and the fryer. It was wild and, you know, chaotic, and people were still smoking in restaurants in those days, and I decided that wasn't quite the thing for me, but I had fun talking about the history of the place, and, you know, there's only a handful of restaurants in Boulder that, well, obviously there's none that are 100 years old, but there's not even many that are 20 years old. What do you think why has the sink had so much staying power? I've seen hundreds of restaurants come and go. I mean,
sure. Know. Yeah, I think, you know, you're an example of that. Just this legacy of memories and tradition has carried it forward. I mean, quite frankly, it has very little to do with Mark and Chris Heinrichs owning it. It's an entity and a force upon itself. It's really a public domain of a restaurant. So many people have so many memories, and at least once a month somebody walks in saying it's their 50th anniversary and they met there, and or that their grandfather went to school there, and their kids are now in school at CU, and just these generations of affection that just carry forward.
It's called The Sink. And the question is, that's not a reference to like a place where you clean your hands. Where did the name The Sink come from?
So there's actually used to be a fountain in the floor of the main room. And when we did a big remodel in 1995, we took the floors back down to the original concrete. And there's a disc in the floor where the fountain used to be. So I've confirmed that this actually existed. And the fountain gained the reputation for the establishment as The Sink instead of The Sunken Gardens.
But it was called Somers Sunken Gardens.
Yeah, and nicknamed The Sink. From as early as I can find out, I met a woman that went to school at CU from 1928 to 1932, and she knew it as The Sink. So that's as close of a reference as I've been able to find. And somewhere around 1949 or so, the Sunken Gardens moniker was dropped off and The Sink was formally adopted. But there's lots of photos of the building with the sink down one side of the facade and some are Sunken Gardens down the other side of the facade. So it was always kind of known as both.
Imagine the things that this restaurant has been witness to besides Robert Redford working there. You know, World War One, World War Two, Vietnam. There was rationing. There was pandemics. There was, yeah. You know,
the countercultural. Excuse me, counterculture revolution during the 70s.
Yes, yeah. When the Hill was quite a bouncy place, let's just say. There was a lot of people don't remember how interesting things were.
Right,
there.
And the music history. I mean, people don't understand or aren't aware of how important Tulagi's was to the music history on the Hill, and the Sink was part of that too. So.
Right. So the documentary is going to be shown next Wednesday night at the Boulder Theater. And it's, tell me about that event.
So we're going to have the first viewing of it. I haven't seen the movie. I didn't know you were in it. I didn't even know you worked at the Sink. So I'm looking forward to seeing all those gems for the first time in person with everybody else that's there. And just this telling of the story, you know, I think Bruce and Mike at Pixel Mill, who knew of the Sink, weren't really part of the Sink. And so seeing how somebody else pulls together the Sink's history and what their perspective is will be really interesting.
Having just visited the newly revamped Casa Bonita, I'm thinking, you know, there's sort of a resonance there, you know, where a revived and revered, you know, institution really happened. The event is on the 14th is partially a benefit.
Yeah, so we're going to have a portion of the proceeds. We'll go to the Imagine Foundation, who we've worked with closely over the last, I don't know, 15 years or so.
And they are?
And so they're an organization that works with people with mental or brain disabilities, whether that's you're born with it or you had an accident or something like that. And they help people find jobs and you know, get back into the mainstream of life.
Will there be Sink burgers
at the event? that's a little bit of a complicated thing to pull together.
No, that was no, that was kind of a joke.
But we will have our 1923 beer that was brewed just for us by Avery, so we'll have that on tap.
And that was the big year. And was there anything that happened in 1923 that you've discovered about, you know, when the restaurant started? I'm trying to think back. So it's post-war, right?
Yeah. You know, the population of Boulder then was maybe 12,000 people. So it's a much smaller city. So when you think about 12,000 people to 102,000 or whatever we're at now, it's a lot of change.
Yeah, the food scene's quite a bit different than it is now, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, Boulder really, through our tenure of the Sink, Boulder really got on the map as a destination food place, and so many interesting restaurants have popped up, and you can find such great food in Boulder. The concentration of good food in Boulder per capita is on its own level.
Yeah. And let's see, Shannon?
Well, I'm going to ask you about what's in your Nibbles column today. You mentioned Casa Bonita. Did you write about it?
I didn't. What I wrote about, I interviewed the very well-known food writer, Ruth Reichel, who's one of the best-known, you know, food authors in the country. She's coming to town to show a documentary on the precarious position that American farmers and ranchers are in. And so I talked to her a lot about those issues. I also asked her, what's the best thing you've tasted lately? And you can read about that in the Boulder Weekly today.
But what's the best thing you've tasted lately?
You know, I always like dishes that kind of cross genres. And I had Southwestern latkes. Latke, of course, crispy potato pancake, you know, traditionally served with applesauce, sour cream at Jewish delis. But at the Morning Glory Cafe in Lafayette, they serve a Southwestern latke Benedict, in effect. And it was just really good. You know, there was just something about the green chili and all that with it that I really liked. The other thing I wanted to mention is that KGNU is having a plant sale. Sunday was not a good day to be shopping for plants. It was a little damp. We have a lot of wonderful vegetables and other plants at KGNU that you can pick up for a bargain down here. Come down and help the station.
Great. Well, that's going to do it for today's Morning Magazine. Again, that's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host and producer, Shannon Young. Thanks to Benita Lee, Pam Johnson, Alexis Kenyon, Kira Zizzo, Jacob Agatston, Poor Jaijong Kit, Ryan Bigham, Jamie Sudler, Franny Halperin, John Lindorf, and Mike Heinrichs for their contributions to today's program. Stay tuned for Black Talk with Michelle Simpson. That's going to be coming up on the other side of the BBC News headlines.